Hearing Mort Robertson's 18 August 1972 at the Coptain Lab. Now, you were at Berkeley when the radio astronomy was just getting going.
Right.
What year was this now when you left?
Well, I left Berkeley in 60, and the radio telescope at Hat Creek, the 85-footer, was just being built. I remember going up a month or two before I left, and it's in lovely country. And it was a very nice place to visit. But the telescope itself was in bits and pieces scattered on the ground, and welding crews were around and the like. It was built, I guess the dish itself was a Philco dish, and Berkeley saved money by doing a lot of the construction themselves, and Philco wanted to get into the game, and so they gave Berkeley a rather nice price on it. I'm sure they didn't make any money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as far as radio astronomy is concerned, Harold Weaver was the man behind it, and he really pushed like mad to get that project going. The inspiration and the reasons, the reasons would perhaps be evident, his own interest in galactic structure and a lot of the work that had been done in Holland on galactic
structure.
So it was
thought mainly for hydrogen line work.
It was thought mainly for hydrogen line work, and in fact that's what they did for the first few years. And then I'm not sure about OH, but if they've been involved in a long-term formaldehyde project.
Right, they were part of the discovery of OH emission in 65.
That's right, the mysterium,
right.
The variability which was not...
But now Weaver was an optical astronomer before.
That's right.
How did he get...
Weaver is amazingly competent in techniques and theory, and the fact that it was a different technique wouldn't faze him, and he very quickly mastered it. And I remember a few of the lectures in his course on, I guess it was galactic structure, it might have been an astrophysics, an elementary astrophysics course he gave, in which he summarized things very nicely about 21 centimeter. Roughly at about that time, Bracewell had just come to this country as a young visitor. Struve, I guess, brought him over.
Mm-hmm.
And Bracewell's book, Bracewell and Pawsey, had just come out. It came out in the middle of his course, and his lectures were, in essence, out of the book with a lot of expansion. But that sort of introduced radio astronomy.
Yeah.
To Berkeley.
There were no dishes there before.
No. Space Science might have had a small dish. Sam Silver's group might have been doing some high-frequency stuff, but I don't recall. They were in another building, another area on a big campus.
Right. Now, you mentioned Bracewell. Was there anything at Stanford at this time?
No.
Did he start that up?
Bracewell started that up. He went, as I recall, he went back to Australia. And then he came back to this country going directly to Stanford. That would have to be checked.
Yeah.
But when he got to Stanford, he built their interferometer there.
I see.
I remember one tale from Struve at Berkeley. When he was editor of the Astrophysical Journal, he told the tale of receiving this manuscript from an unheard of sort of amateur astronomer, electrical engineer named Claude Reber. And it was a map of the sky, primarily the Milky Way, at radio wavelengths. And Struve didn't know what to do with this manuscript. I mean,
yeah.
Was this a crank?
This is a 1940 paper.
I was a little later, I think. I thought it was during the war. I'd put it in the mid-40s.
Or 42, maybe.
Yeah. And he asked astronomers who had not heard of him for obvious reasons, and they just were not versed in the problems of radio astronomy at all. I don't know if he got any advice from Double E's. They probably had heard of him. And Struve just decided that he couldn't get any competent referee on this, and so he decided to go out on his own and publish it. And of course, it, if you will, was the second classic paper, the
right,
first
right.
Being from, or
so
paper from
Jansky. A bit of a risk you took then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. while reminiscing about these tales, I can read. Nowadays, it's quite fashionable to think of explosions in the nuclei of all galaxies, and sort of a continuum going from our own galaxy up to the Seyfertz or M82 type.
Yeah.
But I can recall a conversation at Berkeley, long before this became fashionable, a conversation with Weaver, where we'd started out talking about the 3 kiloparsec arm, and he very clearly outlined at that time, and I would place that in the mid to late 50s, 55, 6, 7, something like that, where he outlined very clearly the picture we have a decade or more, 15 years later.
Of explosions?
Of explosions, that is, the weak kind in our own galaxy, and then perhaps a whole continuum of this with the Seyfert galaxies representing the other end of the spectrum. Of course, this was pre-quasars and things of that sort.
Did he ever publish any ideas of this?
No. No, he did not. Weaver has published a number of very interesting and, in essence, basic papers, but he's also has a lot, like so many astronomers, and he's so busy, so much in his drawer.
Yeah.
That is not published, and this was just discussion.
Yeah. Now, Struve is an interesting figure, because he's an example of an optical... was he an observer or a theoretician?
Struve was essentially an observer with an excellent understanding of the theoretical problems, and so he could do justice... to his discussions.
Bit of both.
Right.
But now he's a person who, well, starting with this Reber thing, but then he was head of NREO for
that's right.
a short while, so what do you know about him?
Well, Struve left Berkeley, I believe the year before I left Berkeley, and he went to NREO. I left Berkeley in 60, he left in 59. And I think it was in part his feeling that he owed an obligation. There had been this lengthy search for a director for NREO. I don't know who they'd gone after. And they weren't having much success for one reason or another. And Struve, whether he was on the search committee or had been approached, I don't know, but he decided that he would take this position. It is a bit of a shame because he had had, I'd say a couple of years before, a very serious accident at the 60-inch at Mount Wilson. To work far south at the 60-inch, at least in those days, you had to get up on a sort of a housing by the dome slit, a housing which... covered a winch, I believe, and then, or part of this winch arrangement, and then you by hand crank down the windscreen on the shutter.
Mm-hmm.
And all one could figure out is that either he slipped or he might have had one of these fractional second blackouts and then slipped. And he slipped rather badly and fell and broke innumerable ribs and chipped things and was, in a hospital in Pasadena for a while. I believe Bob Kraft was in the mountain, probably at the 100-inch, and was the first astronomer to get to him. They got him down to a hospital in Pasadena, and then they shipped him by, that's not the way to put it, they transported him by ambulance to Berkeley, and I remember visiting him there. And the hospital is surrounded by literature and the like, but he was obviously suffering, and it was a major accident.
Okay.
And for a person his age, and what would it have been, perhaps 60, that's a lot to go through. And I feel that physically he never recovered from that. He, of course, kept going, and then he went to Green Bank just in the midst of the terrible headaches regarding the 140-foot.
Mm-hmm.
And this didn't help. And after, I guess, a couple of years, he was well-liked, as far as I can tell, very well-liked by everybody at NREO in Green Bank. And there is still, in essence, sort of a strange memorial to him there, the Redwood House, which was the first director's residence. And Mrs. Struve wanted to live not in the backwoods, if you will, but close to a road, so this was built along fairly close to the highway there, and somebody said, well, coming from California, I will have to build it of redwood, and so the outside siding is that. It's a very comfortable house, and now it's sort of the club at NRAO where social functions are often held, but it was, in essence, the Struve residence.
And now he died while he was still director, is that?
No. He gave that up after a couple, 3 years, whether it was for health reasons or what, I don't know. I wasn't there. I was at Harvard at the time. And he had a joint appointment, half-time in Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study and half-time at Caltech.
I see.
And I remember having a very long discussion with him at the Agassiz Station. He was on the Harvard Visiting Committee. And Struve, during my acquaintance with him when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, there were a number of parties he'd give for the graduate students. He didn't drink much. He might have in his early days, Yerkes, I don't know. He didn't then. I remember his once donating a bottle of cognac to some student gathering, one that when Neyman spotted was a little irked at because he'd given this bottle to Struve. But at this visiting committee gathering, there was a great big punch bowl, and it was very tasty, and Struve didn't realize how laced it was, and he kept asking me to get him more. And he was glad to see an old familiar Berkeley face anyway, and so Joey and I had a very lengthy talk with him, and he was suffering from insomnia at the time. He'd never gotten over his experiences in the construction of the 140. Everything combined, I think primarily that accident, that he was just suffering from that. And it was maybe a half year or a year later that he died.
Now, was he the first director of NREO, or was there someone?
He was the first director named as such. The president of AUI, Lloyd Birkner, might have also had the position of acting director. I'm not sure.
I see.
Heeshan, in essence, was the senior person on the site, and so he had many of the headaches, if you will, of the local person.
This still seems very strange to have an optical, half optical, half theoretical guy running, especially at a critical stage when you're building essentially the problems are engineering, it would seem to me, or was it designed to get somebody who was not, didn't know the details?
Well, in theory, the engineering aspects and those things should have been handled by an engineering group. Ort is not an engineer, and yet he was around and responsible, if you will, for Westerbork, and it's a function of your staff. Now, Struve had vast amounts of administrative experience at Yerkes, at Berkeley. He knew his way around. He was in all the committees, worldwide recognition. And so, as far as getting an administrator is concerned, and one with a good reputation, and the fact that it was a different wavelength than he was used to using shouldn't be any strike against him.
But why did they have trouble getting a director? Was it seen as sort of possibly a dead-end sort of situation?
Well, all directorships are dead-end, if you will. That is where you go from there unless you become a dean or a college president, as has happened, say, at Berkeley. Campbell, I believe, was president of the university or chancellor of Berkeley.
Well, but I mean, as far as there were too many problems associated with this.
I don't know. Here, I just don't know. I'm sure the isolation problem could have been a factor, just as it ultimately caused the move of the scientific staff from Green Bank.
Right.
My own feeling is that it was good in the early days that the scientific staff were located next to the telescopes. There was nothing else to do but science, and this helped getting Green Bank on a nice footing.
Yeah.
It's obvious now things are running so smoothly that, and it's visitor-oriented anyway, with most of the time going to visitors, that you don't have to be next to your telescope.
Yeah. They didn't have that policy in the beginning, that you had to have more than 60% visitors or something?
I don't know if it was called off in numbers, but they had visitors. I was one of the first few visitors back in, I think it was in 58, the 85-footer had just been accepted. In fact, the people from Blois and Ox were still coming out to tighten bolts here and there. And I came out from Berkeley. I had an NSF postdoc fellowship and did a little bit of work with the 85-footer. It was fun.
Okay, so you did some stuff while you were still at Berkeley.
Right.
Some radio astronomy.
Right.
What exactly?
Two things. One, I looked for hydrogen in globular clusters because of my thought that there might be dust in globular clusters.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, as a result of talking with Su Shu Huang, he had some thoughts at that time that there some of the peculiarities in the spectrum of Spica might be due to a magnetic field, a significant magnetic field. And so the question arose, was this a radio star?
Mm-hmm.
And so I made some X-band observations of Spica with negative results. In those days, the reduction of any sort of data was tricky because, not tricky, but tedious.
Yeah.
It was just a chart recorder. Right. And while I was there, they got a Hewlett-Packard digital voltmeter. And that's it. There were three different stages. At first, you could get just a strip chart record, and there was a voltmeter, but no printout. And so you sat in a comfortable red leather chair, and every 10 seconds or integration period, whatever it was, you would write down the reading on this digital voltmeter. And then before I left, they got another digital voltmeter with a printout, a Hewlett-Packard system. And so this was much nicer.
Right.
But you can see how far we've gone since in 15 years.
So they did have some visitors anyway at that time.
Oh, yes. I overlapped with Westerhout, who wanted to continue his galactic survey at X-band. Of course, he ran into problems of opacity and emission from terrestrial clouds. Something that had been vaguely predicted, but it
X-band is what, 3 centimeters?
3 centimeters, it was 3.8 as I recall.
Yeah. And Noah, how did you get interested in radio astronomy? You were mainly optically trained. Is that true?
Yes, I got my degree doing optical work. In fact, something old-fashioned, star counts, looking at the luminosity function in open clusters. Well, as I mentioned before, there was a lot of discussion going on at Berkeley. There was Bracewell's exposure, there was Hat Creek going. It seemed it was obvious that it was an exciting new area, and it was at a time when even a graduate student could have read essentially all of the papers in radio
right.
astronomy.
Right.
This is far from the case now. And so it was very evident at that point that it was an exciting area, and it wasn't clear to me that I'd be going into radio astronomy at that time, but it seemed like another probe. I was always interested in galaxies, per se, and this seemed like a very nice probe for galaxies. And in fact, this is why when I got to Harvard, it was the first thing I got involved in was the line system at Harvard. They had at that time, the most sensitive, the lowest noise system in the world. This was at least at 21 centimeters, this was a Maser, which had been built by John Jelly from Harwell and Brian Cooper from Australia. And the great ability at experimental techniques by these two people is the reason that it was, in essence, the only successful Maser in astronomy, in radio astronomy.
This is 1960 when you got there.
Yes, well, it had been operating for, I guess, at least a year of that order before I arrived, maybe half a year. There was a paper by a large group of Harvard people, an abstract about that time of the detection of a number of galaxies. They had looked very mm-hmm. hastily at perhaps 10 of the obvious cases and made detections. It was a small dish, but even so, a 60-footer with a 100-degree system, one could really do very, very well. I might mention it also helped to have Bloombergen, who, as I understand it, was the originator of the suggestion of the three-level solid-state maser.
Right.
And so here you had the theoretical know-how and the experimental people, and so Harvard got on the map in terms of extragalactic hydrogen.
Bloomberg was in the physics department?
Yes. I guess my interest and background in extragalactic systems, which was obviously lacking at that particular stage of the Harvard staff, there weren't people who had worked or had particularly great interest in galaxies. Well, my interest plus the fact that here was the instrument that caused me to go into to put my emphasis in that direction. I did try doing some work with the 61-inch. It was a telescope at Agassiz. It was forever under being refurbished, being improved. And I remember one night, and I think this is a fairly unique experience, spending the first half of the night with a graduate student observing with the 61-inch, and the second half of the night just walking down the hill to the 60-footer and looking at galaxies 21 centimeter. I got awfully disgusted with the 61-inch and was improved after that because we were getting double images, and it looked like the support system for the mirror was not operating properly, and indeed this was the case. I yelled loud and strong, and they knew there were problems anyway. I shouldn't take any of the credit. And many of the bellow systems, which had sort of a hydraulic fluid in them, had leaked. And mm-hmm. so there was, in essence, these had frozen, and they were distorting the mirror. This is why there were double images.
But the 60-foot worked well.
Very nice. Very nice.
So what did you do with the 60-foot?
Most of the work that I was involved in, and I think this represented, most of the work was on galaxies. There were some other projects. For instance, Nan Dieter did the high-velocity clouds, although she was doing galaxies, too, and that was her thesis at Harvard, M33.
Where is that published?
I don't think it's been published.
I don't think so. I don't think I've ever seen that.
No. You'd have to get it as a thesis.
Mm-hmm.
She, of course, had a big battle in the sense that the argument was, is hydrogen extended around a galaxy or not?
And further than the optical?
Right. Or? And, of course, this is a poorly defined case because how do you compare isotopes and the like? And she said, yes, it was bigger than the optical. This, by the way, is an argument that still rages, much to my surprise. But there's no question that she was right. And most, at least of the later type systems that have been studied with this in mind, show that the hydrogen image, even to comparable isotopes, however you want to normalize them, is much bigger in hydrogen than in optical. And you still encounter remarks in the literature that there's no extension. But I think the situation here is that one is sensitivity limited, and they just sort of stop observing.
Anyway, I got you distracted. You were talking about
it was extragalactic work. I guess I was, Ed Lilly was in charge of the group. Eugene Epstein was the graduate student doing work in this area, and I was the staff member doing work in this area. Nan had a research, she was at Air Force Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
but had a research associate appointment at Harvard and was using the Agassiz station. There are others, May, Kasson, In fact, she was the first person to take me out to Agassiz, and I watched her observe. And it was not a trivial thing to fill the maser with helium, which you had to do yourself. It was an open door to make the adjustments that were necessary. And if anything went wrong, why, you had to call Sam Goldstein, who fortunately lived in the town of Hartford. And he was very good about coming out at ungodly hours to help us and everyone out if problems were encountered. So it was a fun group. It was built by very capable people. The small technical staff there was excellent that maintained it. The astronomers were a small group who were interested in using it, and there was good, I'd say by and large, good rapport. And
and you really had no competition at this time either, as far as your hydrogen capabilities go?
Not really.
Plus interest.
Plus the interest, of course.
The Dutch could have done similar things.
The Dutch at that time didn't have that much bigger a dish. Where they hurt, of course, was in the sensitivity of the receiver. And their interests, they had made important contributions in extragalactic hydrogen, but if you go into the papers, you'll see the hundreds of hours that it took them to get a profile or a map of a galaxy. And at that time, the system was more or less 1,000 degrees versus 100.
Oh, it was that bad? I see.
At least the early galactic work, it was, I think, noisier than 1,000. Mm. Now, when it was continually improved, and I just can't date those improvements. But that gives you some idea of the difference that one would gain in integration time. It's rather interesting with your own interest that at that time, we were already talking about the possibility of black galaxies. I think the phrase originated with Ed Lilly, but I'm not sure. The idea was, are there isolated hydrogen blobs of galactic mass of just pure hydrogen?
That don't shine. No.
And of course, we were forever getting bumps, which were noise. And the joke became this one, of course. We quickly found out that it was just noise. I remember one period when we got very excited about, in fact, it was the time of the Berkeley IAU, about trying to look at a comet. There had been reports in the literature about continuum radiation from a comet. And now my memory fails me whether we tried continuum or line.
Did you ever publish this?
We didn't get anything worth publishing. And
this is 61 then, the Berkeley.
This was 61. It was a very bright, supposed to be a bright appearing comet, and I can't recall the details now. We were getting, I guess I was on the phone to Leland Cunningham at Berkeley getting updated ephemerides, but then I was going to the IAU and I left it in the hands of some of the people there, I can say I left it, we were all working together. And nothing much came of, that is, nothing was detected. And I think
it still hasn't been. A lot more.
That's right.
Looks.
And the feeling of just another negative paper sort of welled up in us. And
So what was your program? Was to just first do a survey of the most obvious candidates to see what the hydrogen looked like?
Yes. One wanted to get a more meaningful sample of galaxies, with the idea of learning about galaxies, obviously, rather than just to get hydrogen per se. And it was at that point that we worked out the problems of estimating total masses. Volders and Hoogbaum had done this for a irregular. I don't think they applied the same technique to spirals, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check. Excuse me, the literature. On
where was that published?
The Volders Hoogbaum in the BAN. Yeah. They did 6822 and got a total mass estimate by just assuming a Gaussian distribution of.
And you were doing all galaxies that were unresolved.
The beam was 50 some odd minutes.
Right.
And there were a few galaxies on Epstein's program that were roughly comparable if you take the hydrogen size into account to the beam. That is more or less a degree. Some southern ones like 253. I can't recall them. In fact, he thought he had seen the a bit of rotation, so one was resolving in a few of these, but the vast majority of the galaxies were unresolved. And this made life much simpler. You just we spoke of milli-Virgo units for our calibration. We just tied into to Virgo.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we always had great arguments about calibrations and things like that, and beam efficiency. But it was nice working together. And,
so it was. Was there any galactic work done on the dish at that time? Was the OH work.
That was later. That was
three or four years later.
That's right. There was, of course, Dieter's high velocity. Well,
that's right.
Clouds towards the North Galactic and I think South Galactic pole.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That's right.
Not while I was there. Bob Davis's thesis had been finished the year before, I believe. There might have been, but I just can't recall.
What was his thesis then?
It was a section of the galactic plane destined 21 centimeter, like a number of the studies that came out from Harvard and from Holland.
Was that ever published?
I think not, but I'm not sure.
Now, what about Continuum? Or was it spending almost all of its time on extragalactic hydrogen, the dish?
There were, Sam, that's right. Sam was working on Continuum measurements of normal galaxies and, of course, and perhaps 3C sources. One has to be very, you got some interesting results, but if ever there was a situation where source confusion would come in,
right.
It's with a 1 degree beam. So there was Sam's Continuum work.
Did he ever publish any of that?
He had some interesting things in that were published. I remember one on normal galaxies in the AJ. A student, I think he was an undergraduate at the time, named John Liebacher, did a Continuum map of Andromeda. I'm sure there are others in my memory, just I think even then May Kasem might have been working on planetary nebulae. As a summer student, there was a summer school, and Yervant Terzian was one of the summer students, and I think he did planetaries then. That might have been his I don't know if he came interested in them, but he made some observations with the 60-footer. We had a babysitting sort of arrangement with the telescope because of the dangers with the helium and the like. There always had to be two students, one who was doing his observing. They were allowed to use the telescope, and the other just had to be present just in case of any equipment failure or any danger or any accident. And the students griped about this babysitting arrangement, or telescope sitting, as they called it.
But
it was a necessary safety factor.
This is the end of Side A. Please flip over. It's the middle of the interview with Mort Roberts on 18 August 72.